Hello, my name is Holly Lewis.
I'm Lawson Keeney.
And I'm Jean Lewis.
And welcome to The Long Watch, the internet's premier pro John Lithgow podcast where we stick to lists for better or worse. This week we have reached back into science fiction territory. With a movie I ended up quite enjoying.
It's sort of a blockbuster science fiction thriller in a similar vein to others that we've touched on.
See, I can't get there with the sci-fi thing because there's no science in it. Like, it's more of fantasy.
Fair.
Sure, but that's one explanation.
Yep, I guess we'll get into that. We, of course, are talking about The Adjustment Bureau, based on the short story The Adjustment Team by Philip K. Dick. Before we get into that, we'll talk about what we've seen within the week. Lawson, why don't you start us off?
Sure thing. I am going to start with a movie that I saw in the cinemas. It is Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, which is a fantasy adventure film directed by James Mangold. It follows Indiana Jones, once again played by Harrison Ford. He's leading a lonely and unsatisfying existence in 1969 United States. He's found by his goddaughter Helena, played by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is pursuing an ancient dial that is thought to be able to give the user the ability to navigate rifts in time, to basically a compass. And a Nazi NASA scientist named Voller, played by Mads Mikkelsen, is pursuing her. He was a Nazi in World War II when he was one of the scientists that America brought over to help with the space program. And Indiana is swept up in the pursuit of all of this. You might want to sit a little closer to the mic, John. I think that you're a little quiet from my ears. This is probably the weakest Indiana Jones movie, but it is a decent send-off. What really works for me is the acknowledgement of his age. They don't try and fudge it. Like, Harrison Ford is just straight up an 80-year-old man, and they play into that, into the themes of the movie. It's the idea that this is sort of a world that's no longer his. It's left him behind. You get this big opening thing, which there's been a lot of media about. They've de-aged Harrison Ford, and you get Indiana Jones in the Second World War again, and it's young Indy, and then you smash cut into 1969, and there's a parade outside for the astronauts returning from the moon, and Indiana Jones is just an old man in a shitty New York apartment yelling at his neighbor Larry for playing music too loud. Like, this is a guy who it's not his time anymore, and you get a really interesting way where that scene from the first movie is matched here. You had that scene where after he'd come back from the cold open trip, you had all of the students just waiting with bated breath to hear his lecture on archaeology. They don't give a shit anymore. You know, they want to go outside and see the astronauts. They don't care about the history, they care about the future now. And it's sort of that way, and it's matched again with the Mads Mikkelsen character. Like, this is a guy who, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, wants to go back in time to change the outcome of World War II. Like, both of these guys are people that the world has sort of moved on from. They're relics of a previous era. And that's the most interesting part. It's what makes it feel like an ending. Indy just isn't as spry anymore either. Like, it goes beyond thematics. He doesn't go hand to hand because he can't win. He will do it if he has to, if there's no other option. But he never comes out on top. Like, seriously, I'm trying to think. I don't think he ever engages in a physical encounter with an opponent that he actually wins. Like, it's like, how many times do I have to teach you this lesson, old man? It really is that. He gets knocked around.
Mangold is good for stuff like that, showing the age of our heroes.
That's kind of his shtick. Yeah.
It handles the hanging continuity of the fourth movie very well in a way that I actually think adds to this fifth movie.
Desperately needed to.
Yes, it's quite clever. And again, I think it kind of... You'll know what I mean when I see it, but it sort of adds to some of the broader ideas that the movie is handling. But it also really builds up to a strong finale that offers something really super interesting, but it doesn't take the shot at the end. Like, it pulls back at the worst possible places that it could pull back, and it doesn't go for it. It reverts to type. It reverts to the same type of Indiana Jones story that we've seen many times before, when it could have gone that extra step and done something. And it's kind of structured in such a way that it makes you wonder whether that originally was the plan, that they were going to go there, but then someone at Disney was like, shit, no, you saw what happened with that Star Wars movie. Just do the same thing again. The bad...
How's Mangold's direction?
I mean, it's good. It's kind of inconsistent visually. The CG is pretty wonky. There are some, like, Flash-level CG problems here. It's not as constant as it was in The Flash, but every time you see a digital stunt double, they look terrible. Like, the physics and the movement are all off. The de-aging is the best so far, but it still is inconsistent. You can still see the weirdness of it.
I think the best experience I've had with that de-aging stuff that so far was probably Captain Marvel.
All of the stuff with Samuel L. Jackson, though he hunches over when he
not,
gets a little
to
more.
To be fair, Samuel L. Jackson looks almost exactly the same now as he did in the 90s anyway. It's a bit
There's
more of a visual difference.
Easier job.
Yeah.
Samuel L. Jackson has aged beautifully.
The thing that really, beyond the visuals, the thing that really throws it here, I think, is Ford's voice. His voice is just so much more gravelly now, and it wasn't back then, but they've done nothing to his voice. He sounds like an 80-year-old man in those
Perhaps
scenes.
Indy got into smoking.
The bad guy could have been more interesting, though. They should have matched the actor to Ford. It's actually a problem, I think, when Mikkelsen is in the opening as well, and they've done a little bit of de-aging to him, but not much. Like, he looks exactly the same age as Harrison Ford in the original.
He should be around Harrison Ford's age.
And why not? Why not bring in someone like Gary Oldman or Christoph Waltz or someone who's got a little more, they should have matched the actor to Ford and done the same thing.
Someone else who's a little bit more long in the tooth.
And they haven't. And that's created, I think, another missed opportunity. It has all these themes and these ideas, but it does sometimes feel like it's too nervous to engage. And it does end up being like a too long retread for large amounts of it. There are decent action sequences, and Ford is great. It's clear that I'm actually really liking the Fordissants we've gotten ever since really Star Wars, I suppose, came back.
Star Wars, Blade Runner, Indy.
And the TV stuff he's doing now and going into Marvel. I mean, he's engaged in a way that it seemed like he wasn't for a while.
Give me my Harrison Ford Red Hulk, guys. I desperately want that
I
shit.
I do love how in those interviews, though, Harrison Ford's like, Red Hulk, who's that? I don't know. I don't care.
I feel like I was surprised that he was in the Captain America movie as well. I thought it was just going to be Thunderbolts, because I thought there's no way they're getting Harrison Ford for any considerable stretch of time. Maybe
Ford saw that John Hurt played him before and was like, okay, so this character has some heft to it.
I don't know. I feel like...
Until they pump him full of radiation, baby. Yeah.
I feel like at worst, you're just going to get him for those two movies, and I think that probably be likely.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Dude's getting on.
At worst, he comes back in one of the Kang two-parter stories and gets killed off in that.
How's Phoebe Waller-Bridge?
I like her, but there's something that's like really forced about her character. Like, it doesn't really feel like, I don't know, there's not an easiness to it. There's sort of almost a self-conscious...
Trying too hard?
Oh, this character's got to be opposite Indiana Jones, so we've got to, like, make her a match.
So almost like if you've got Phoebe Waller-Bridge in to play herself.
Yeah, there are a couple of times it really works, because she is a little... She takes the humor too far, and Indy is sort of just over it. Like, there's one moment where a guy that's helping them out, I don't consider this a spoiler, but skip forward 30 seconds if you think anything is going to be a spoiler. I don't think this'll spoil anything, but there's one moment where a guy that Indy knew back in the day... Actually, no, that is a spoiler. I won't go there. But there's a moment where you see a collision of personalities, and that stuff is the most interesting stuff that her character brings, but it doesn't really tie itself together at the end. You don't mm-hmm. really get the payoff. Yeah, it's good. I'm glad that we got Ford back one more time. It does make me wonder, you know, I think having seen it, I probably would have preferred one more Lucas Spielberg run because it feels like someone, whether it's Mangold or the studio, is just being a little too precious with it. And I feel like if...
standing in its own way.
Yeah, if Crystal Skull taught us nothing, it's that Spielberg and Lucas aren't that precious with it.
No.
I would have been interested to see that.
How was Williams?
Williams'
score.
It's strong fine. Beat. It's another Indiana Jones score. I mean, he doesn't really bleat. There's not really a standout piece of music here. It's mostly just sort of remixes or reuses of the earlier stuff. The new stuff doesn't leave much of a mark.
I mean, it's not like it's Star Wars.
Hmm.
Star Wars is going to be the thing that Williams is remembered for.
I mean, he'll also be remembered for Indiana Jones.
Yeah, but Star Wars is
Williams also did Superman.
Yeah,
so.
But Star Wars, that's the theme. Yeah. Probably in all of cinema, that's the theme. I don't know. There's just something that I think... What the Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull did was that they took that sort of pulp fiction idea and they mapped it to the 50s.
Yeah.
With all of the alien stuff. It would have been interesting if they had lent into that a little bit more and matched it to something from the late 60s or the 70s, because frankly, I do think they fudged the dates a little bit. I think that this should be taking place in the 70s, given the distance since that first movie.
And how much older he is now compared to Crystal Skull?
Anyways, it's worth watching. It's a lot of fun. And as an ending for that character, I don't think it's perfect, but I do think it engages with the legacy of that character in a really interesting way. In a way that's interesting enough to make you disappointed they didn't do a little more with it. Mm. At home, I saw I Am Number 4. It's a young adult science fiction romance directed by DJ Caruso.
It's one of these.
Based on the novel by Pittacus Law. And it follows a refugee alien teenager named John, played by Alex Pettifer, who is got a guardian, an alien guardian with him named Henry, played by Timothy Olyphant. Helpfully, they both just look like humans. John is one of nine special survivors from this planet that has been annihilated by a race of aliens with the hilarious name of Mogadorians. And the Mogadorians have found them, and they're now killing them all off in order for some reason. He's number 4, and number 3 has just died. And this interrupts his romancing of local girl Sarah, played by Diana Agron. This is dopey, but amiable. I mean, it is one of those. It is one of the Twilight also rans, Harry Potter also rans. It's a Frankenstein's monster of story elements. This one is Twilight with aliens. The world building is quite poor. You get very little context and background as to
these. Do you think the Mogadorians might be so angry because they're called the Mogadorians?
Well, yeah, they got these like really sharp teeth and like gills and things too. The puppy dog love stuff is less self-serious than Twilight, but it's no less corny. I mean, you get this bit where Timothy Olyphant very, very seriously tells Alex Pettifer that, you know, now that he's fallen in love, that's it, because their species loves forever.
Timmy.
And you can see how, I suppose, for a teenage girl, that might be a wonderful thing, but for the jaded...
Does Oliphant sell that line?
No, no, he doesn't.
No, you can see behind his eyes that he's not all there for it.
He was a replacement, too. It was going to be Charlton Copley, I think, who wouldn't have been able to sell that line either. But,
no.
I can't pick an actor who can.
You get all Gary this, Oldman. Like, Degrassi High stuff with Jake Abel, who's playing a...
I do like how your shorthand is Degrassi High.
Yeah. He's playing like this...
That or the OC.
This local bully who's a rival for his lady loves affections, and it's a step too far. You
Is he
don't
a
need it.
warlock?
No, he's just a normal kid, which is
Oh.
part of the, like, you know, this he's up against his aliens that can, like, shoot lightning and things.
I mean,
It's
you'd think that, you know, for it to be a good Twilight ripoff, it would be an alien and then one of the mole people. But no.
I
The
don't know.
leads are good. Callan McAuliffe plays a supporting role. He's quite fun. It needs more Timothy Oliphant. Timothy Oliphant does class the proceedings up a bit.
Yeah.
You get Kevin Durant as the lead Mogadorian, and it is not good. He's going way, way over the top, and it makes the villain look like an idiot. It's just blatant franchise tease stuff. I mean, Teresa Palmer turns up in the last 20 minutes, what is clearly a very important character to the series. And then there's no resolution to the plot, really. They just manage to hold the Mogadorians off and then go on the run to be continued.
Part of me loves seeing that in
Yeah.
these film
It's just
examples.
seeing all of the ego get punished.
Yeah, it's like someone right about to do a slam dunk, then it just gets swatted out of the air.
Yeah.
It's a
Although
perfect.
it's this video that I found of a dude's I think sausage roll getting snatched by a seagull. It's kind of
Yeah,
like
kind of
that.
like that.
It's a perfectly serviceable CW style story, and I like CW shows, or I used to like CW shows before it became the barren nuclear winter hellscape of a post Nexstar acquisition.
Yeah, that's true.
Lastly, for this week, I saw Unknown. It is a psychological thriller directed by Jean Colet-Serra, and it's based on the novel Out of My Head by Didier Van Cowelaert. And it follows a guy named Dr. Martin Harris. He's played by Liam Neeson. He's in Berlin with his wife, Liz, played by January Jones, where because he is giving a presentation at a biotech conference. And he gets in a car accident when he's
Yes.
over there. And falls into a coma, and when he awakes, no one recognizes him. He goes to his hotel, and no one knows who he is. His wife doesn't recognize him, and there's some other guy there saying that he's Dr. Martin Harris.
Oh shit, he's just been adjusted.
This is solid but generic. I mean, after the premise, which is a decent enough premise, it devolves into usual Liam Neeson action movie shenanigans. Neeson carries it. He's less capable this time, which is interesting. He's not, you know, a former CIA agent beating everyone up. He's a little more ordinary guy caught up in extraordinary events.
Is it better than Black Adam?
Yes, it's better than Black Adam. Why would you ask about Black? Oh, 'cause he directed Black Adam. Yeah. Neeson.
I recognized the name.
Well, he's I'm actually a fan of him mostly. I mean, Jean Colet-Serra makes pretty good movies, and also Black Adam. Like
Jungle
he,
Cruise was pretty good.
yeah,
Let's be fair.
he directed
Dwayne the Rock Johnson made Black Adam.
Jungle Cruise, The Commuter, The Shallows, Run All Night, Orphan, House of Wax. I mean, the man's
Yeah.
got a solid repertoire.
I love that House of Wax is among the solid for his repertoire, and Black
is.
Adam's
It's
not.
a solid
It
horror
is,
movie.
actually. Yeah, I
It
like that.
it.
Did you say
Successfully,
Wicker Man?
no, he's not. He's not
Yeah.
the director
No,
of Wicker
God, no.
Man.
Jesus Christ, no.
I must have gotten confused in there, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, the difference between this and House of Wax and Black Adam is House of Wax succeeds in everything it's set out to do. It is exactly the kind of movie it thinks it is, and Black Adam is not. But the mystery unravels at a decent clip. I did call it, but it was my third theory. I junked two before I got
Oh,
there.
you gotta make a list when you're watching a movie like this, you know?
Yeah.
It wastes a fairly talented supporting cast, though. Frank Langella turns up later on in things, and he doesn't get very much to do. January Jones is just straight up awful, like really genuinely terrible. But you do get a very fun scene-stealing performance by Bruno Ganz, who played Hitler in Downfall, the one from the memes.
Nice.
And
Big line.
he is like a former agent from before the wall fell, now working as a private eye, and Martin hires him to help figure out what's
Nice.
going on. He's very fun. But it's available for streaming in Australia on Foxtel now, if anyone's interested. But that is me done for the week. I do have a couple of piss takes, but
Okay.
what about you guys? What have you been watching?
We've only got a couple of things.
Yeah,
I'll
we've only
mention
watched a few things.
I'll mention first. We started on the first half of the most recent season of The Witcher. Finished that. Left us off on a very interesting
Yeah.
point in the story.
And Cavill is doing
It's
fantastically
some of
here.
his best work as the
And
character.
it seems as if he's like, this is what you're gonna be missing. So, yeah.
Some of his best work as the character, and that's really, really funny to me.
Yeah. I'm enjoying it. They've created this family dynamic between Geralt, Yennefer, and Ciri, and I
And that's
really
really
love
good.
seeing
That's
those
really good
scenes.
stuff.
Yeah.
Um,
They
and the
really have
politicking
become,
is better than ever.
they've really become a solid unit. They've become surrogate family
For Siri, yeah.
for each other,
Yeah,
really.
and it does look like they've hewed a good deal closer to the events of that particular portion in the book series, which again is quite interesting.
Yeah, and Joey Beatty as Yaskir is the perfect fun uncle. So,
I'll be very
great show.
interested to see how the recast goes. Because Liam
Because they've been
Hemsworth, I don't
saying
even know why Liam Hemsworth took the job, because there's no winning. Even if he
no.
is fantastic, like it's a perfect performance,
Even if it's a slam
no
dunk,
one
he's
will
going to
admit
be
it.
compared.
No one
It's
will
going
admit
to
it.
be so
Yeah.
noticeable.
Even if he's better than Henry Cavill, no one will
Yeah.
say he's better than Henry Cavill, because
Which.
no one wanted Henry Cavill to leave. So,
Yeah.
like, I don't know. I think one of the producers, I think they accidentally let drop the other month that they've already been renewed for season five, and this is season three. We publicly we know that obviously they've got season four because Liam Hemsworth's in
Yeah.
season
Yeah.
four. But if they got season five, then that would take them all the way through to the very last book. They would just need one more season. So I could actually kind of see this thing limping to a conclusion that covers the entire book series. But
Yeah.
I'll be very interested to see how the next season does.
But as someone who hasn't actually read any of the books, I'm not terribly precious with the story. I just have a great time with it.
Yeah.
It's really strong
It's good
fantasy
fantasy
stuff.
stuff, and it's just satisfying to
You
watch.
see a creature made up of human body parts and meat just writhing around.
Oh yeah, there's a scene in this first half of this season which is absolutely terrifying and gave
Yeah.
me the ick. I was like, absolutely not. If I was in that room, I would have took the sword to myself because I wouldn't be able to continue on having seen that in the
Yeah.
flesh.
What
Literally in the flesh.
has really worked for me in the second and third season thus far is the fact it's linear.
Yeah.
Thank Christ.
Yeah, that does help.
I really struggled with that for a while
Yeah.
in the first season, but then you started noticing things, and I was like, I mean, you're just taking the long way
Yeah.
to getting here, you know? You could have done it. I guess I understand why they did, but I don't know. It
It
just
was
provided a
so they
lot of trouble
could give you
engaging.
the intros to all of the
At the
characters
same time,
in the first season at the same
yeah,
time.
I get that.
And I feel like that's important. But anyway,
Probably
moving
works
on.
better on a rewatch
Anyway,
for me.
moving on. We also watched an Amityville film. Now, Tubi in America has a bunch of these, and
A
we've
bunch
got
of
a
new ones.
new ones. We've got a list that we're going to get through. Amityville Karen is there. Amityville in Space is there.
Amityville
Amityville
Hex.
Is Amityville
Amityville Hex.
Vibrator there?
No,
Then what is the
Vibrator
point
is
of it?
not present.
I know, but Amityville Christmas Vacation is also there. We are saving that for Christmas, though. So we have watched a sequel Amityville film. Oh, no. Not to the main line. No, absolutely not. We watched Amityville Scarecrow 2. They made a second one. This is directed by Adam Cowie, who didn't direct the first. It has been a year since the events of the first film, and the survivors are about to reopen the camp. However, something sinister lurks, and all is not what it seems!
I'll say my short piece about it first. I don't care to learn the names of any of the cast. Because.
What would you?
Why? Would yeah. I?
You're never going to see these people again.
No!
Unless they make an Amityville Scarecrow 3.
Oh, Christ. I hope not.
Most of them die in this movie anyway, okay. So...
You know how we said that the first Amityville Scarecrow was cribbing hard from the backstory presented in Nightmare on Elm Street?
Look, they all blend together, these Amityville movies.
He didn't even watch them!
Yeah.
And they're blending together.
Child Predator gets burned to death by a gang of angry parents. Comes back as some sort of demon. Pretty bluntly, very obvious. This one cribs a little more off of Friday the 13th. And in that regard, it is a smidge more effective as a slasher movie. But that's in comparison to Amityville Scarecrow 1. It's all just trash anyway.
Yeah.
It's not the worst thing I've seen all week. Not by a long shot. We watched the trailer to the new Neil Breen movie. He used to shoot on locations, and now he doesn't, which is fun.
Can you tell that Harley fell asleep watching this? He's got very little to actually say.
No, I actually do have some stuff to say. I like the idea of a demon scarecrow. It's very compelling. It's a very compelling idea for a slasher villain. I liked the imagery of the scarecrow, and I liked the imagery of the scarecrow in the first one.
Mm.
Because
it was a freaky design.
This time around, it's a lot less supernatural, which I did appreciate.
Yeah, but it's just a dude in a costume.
But there's this really, really unnecessary amount of nudity here that really clashes with the first in a bizarre way.
See, what's interesting is it's trying to play itself off as this throwback.
Yeah.
But
it doesn't get it.
Literally the only things that are throwback about it is the fact that there is nudity and sex scenes, and the opening credits have this kind of staticky filter, almost like film grain look to it, almost ripping off the style of the Evil Dead Rise. Not the opening credits, but like just the title there.
God, you made me think of a much better movie.
I know. And it's like, oh, I see what they're going for, but none of that effort is carried through to the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Just trash.
I wasn't done, but it just has no personality in comparison to something like Amityville Curse, which actually has an idea. It has a personality, but like I said when we talked about the first Amityville Scarecrow, that like abandoned car yard, very compelling location.
Oh, yeah.
I love all of the burnt and rusted out cars. It's very, very cool, very, very evocative. And I like the big shed they have at the back with a lot of more rusty old cars in there. It's a very cool location for a slasher movie. We just didn't get a very cool slasher movie from it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was trash.
The actors are possible, but are saddled with the most wooden, uninteresting characters. And none of them are doing their best work. And even when they're given stuff to do, they're given...
That one guy at the beginning.
They give the worst lines and parts to the better actors so that there's less that they can do. It's bizarre. The issue with this movie is there's literally no point for it to exist. Because of this fact, they have to try to wring out a story from what was left from the first one, which is like drawing blood from a stone. The Scarecrow is a guy in a costume from a fancy dress shop, and all of the creativity has left when it comes to the kills, the character interactions, the script. There's no reason for this to be called an Amityville film, other than getting idiots like us to watch them, because we've got worms in our brain that force us to.
I did check, and this is why we do the also discussed section, listeners, is so I can track banal shit like this. This is the 17th episode that has the word Amityville in the description. One of those is me from the Ryan Reynolds remake, but this would be your 16th at least.
Yes.
Yep.
You may have talked about multiple ones in an episode at some point.
Absolutely. We absolutely have. And that number will rise.
And that number will rise because I have...
I want to do Amityville...
An entire list of them phone to watch.
I want to do Amityville Hex next. Because it has a legitimately interesting premise.
It
was shot entirely during the pandemic over Zoom, which there are movies that have done that sort of aesthetic, but it is solely Zoom. So
working, Amityville movie.
A filmmaker working with that kind of limitation might actually come out with something really, really interesting. But, you know, it is the rare Amityville film that ends up good. And we can say that because of the sheer shitload of Amityville films there are. Most are bad. And three guesses as to where we found this one.
You've already said American Tubi.
Yeah, it's our good friends at Tubi. The cockroaches of the streaming service.
I feel like
community.
One day we'll all like find that was just like something that was laundering money for organized crime or something. Like it was just a front.
I honestly would not be surprised. They don't even do 1080p. Of course, it's a front.
You have to let that go. You have to.
You cannot
die on that hill.
You can't say, John.
I mentioned it, John.
You can't say, John, that it is not genuinely inexplicable.
It's not acceptable.
No, it doesn't make sense. But at this point, Lawson, I've given up trying to fit everything into little boxes
and
have everything make sense.
The year 2050, the Long Watch is in its, 31st year of running. You guys are still talking about Amityville movies you watched on
because
Tubi,
they will still be coming
and they
out.
Are still in 480p.
and at this point, we will be injecting movies into little holes in our necks, and that's the way that movies will be.
But it'll still be 480p.
No,
and
we will have to watch them on a television screen, like some kind of Neanderthal.
Yeah.
We'll be elevated beings by that point.
Yeah.
Turning people into pillars of salt, but we'll still have to sit down and watch it on Tubi.
I do have to say, I have a great amount of fun with these Amityville films. Mm. It's a sort of I don't know. It's the same joy from a Neil Breen film.
It lets you appreciate the... It lets you appreciate even middling films.
Yeah.
Like, films that just have all of the technical stuff work. Nothing's exceptional, nothing spectacular, that the movie just works.
Yeah.
It lets you appreciate those ones.
Yeah, it lets you appreciate the fact that there's a flaw to what a studio will accept. You know what I mean? There's a low standard that these Amityville films just plummet through.
Jagged Edge Films has no standard. They will go as low as humanly possible.
Mm. And that's what Tubi's for.
That's what Tubi is for. Movies that they don't even pay for, that are just there for free.
You know, they serve a purpose.
Yeah. But anyway, you said you had a pith take?
I have two.
Ooh.
I am going to start off with a stage show that I went and I saw on Friday night. I went and I saw a local production of 42nd Street, the musical. It is a stage musical written by Michael Stewart and Mark Bramble. It's based on the 1933 film directed by Lloyd Bacon, which was itself based on the 1932 novel by Bradford Ropes. Is it just the surname Bacon, John?
Yeah,
is that why you're giggling to yourself? Okay.
I didn't giggle, I was just smiling.
I was looking at my notes and I heard you. That's why I looked up.
I didn't make a single noise.
You did.
Holly turned to me and looked at me and he was like, I know.
I turned and looked because I knew.
I didn't giggle. I do giggle, but I didn't giggle that time.
It follows a wide-eyed young starlet, Peggy Sawyer. Well, she's not a starlet. She wants to be a star. She was played in this production by Kirsten Brown. She joins a chorus line in a Broadway show directed by the mercurial Julian Marsh, played by Christopher Thomas, who is having problems with his leading lady, Dorothy Brock, played by Carolyn Latter, whose career is in decline. This production was with Savoyards, which is a community theatre group, but about as professional as you can get while still technically being a community theatre group. It was incredibly well put together. Really, the production value of it was very high. The story is very old-fashioned. It's sort of, my understanding of that original movie is that it invented a lot of the cliches. And the narrative of this stage version doesn't hang together super well. It's really just an excuse for a let's put on a show variety act. There are some compelling characters. They're fun to watch, but there's just not much depth to any of them. And you do get some great performances by the cast in this particular production. There is this one old guy who, bless him, I mean, most of the actors are very good. He was not most of the actors. And it's very much like he just couldn't stop grinning. Like, he had this very small role. He turned up every now and again. But even when he was supposed to be angry, he just had this big goofy grin on his face because he was so happy to be there.
He was just having too great a time.
Yeah. And I was really like, he lit the whole stage up, in my opinion. Yeah. I was so thrilled every time he came back.
Can't be mad at that.
And he was like, he looked like he was in his 80s. Like, he was an older gentleman.
I like seeing old people happy. There's something about it that just...
I don't.
The
they
heart,
had
you know?
Their time.
Get in the ground!
I suppose Lawson's an anti-old person.
Oh no, I love old people. It's my ambition to one day be one.
True.
But it's an unfocused story. The conclusion to it is told, not felt. The songs, which were written by Al Dubin and Johnny Mercer with music by Harry Warren, are not super memorable. I mean, the big standout one, the one that people might actually know from this was We're in the Money. We're in the money, we're in the money, we got a lot of what it takes to get along. But this version was well staged. There's a fun 1930s aesthetic, including to the singing. You've got that sort of very sort of flapperish, we're in the money, that kind of...
You got the people talking like this.
Yeah.
Buy your wall balls.
But really the thing of it is, so much tap dancing. And I think it might actually be the first time I've ever seen tap dancing live. And it was really, really good. Like, you just got these fields, all of the performers on stage at once tap dancing. And it's very strong.
It's like having 50 Skimble Shankses trying to come up to you in a dark alley.
They did have some audio problems, though. Some of the microphones started to glitch a little bit at points.
Where at?
It was almost like it wasn't, it was only activating when their voice was at a certain volume.
I know the stuff.
Yeah.
Where was this at, by the way?
The Iona Performing Arts Center.
Yeah.
But yeah, good stuff.
You got to be careful with mics like that. And most people, and I'm putting my stage manager hat on for a little bit here. Most people just wouldn't bother with, you know, sound sensitive mics. So they're more trouble than they're worth, to be completely honest. It's better to just get the performers on stage to shut up.
And the other pith take I have is another video game. It is Deus Ex Mankind Divided.
Here we go.
An immersive sim / action RPG developed by Eidos Montreal. It's set a few years after the first game. Augmented people after the end of that game are now badly discriminated against. They're rounded up into slums. They're stopped at checkpoints. And
Lawson did not help that situation punching everyone.
I did not punch anyone, hardly. I used my sword arms to wage a bloody swath through Cyberpunk.
The wholesale slaughter.
But there is a bombing at a train station in the opening minutes of this game. And Adam Jensen, played by Elias Dufayus, is now working for an international security agency named TF-29, which is linked to Interpol. And, they're investigating it, but Adam Jensen is also secretly investigating TF-29 itself for an activist collective named Juggernaut. And as he investigates both TF-29 and the train station bombing, he finds connections to the Illuminati that reveal the bombing to have been a false flag designed to further the Illuminati's efforts to manipulate human culture, civilization, progression, whatever.
You know,
sort of like an
Illuminati
evil
stuff.
I had a very Adjustment Bureau, like Illuminati style style run this week. This is an excellent expansion to the template that Human Revolution set up. It generally improves on just about everything. I mean, the controls and the gameplay are just so intuitive and really brilliantly placed together. The level design is meticulous. You got a couple of hub levels in the original Human Revolution game. you only get the one this time, Prague, but
it's much larger.
It's larger than either of the two were, but probably smaller in total. But it there's just so much more detail. It's so much denser. You can go into so many more spaces. It connects in so many more different ways.
Well, you see, that's the trick about making an open world or hub-based system more effective. It's not about size. It's about density. I played through Gotham Knights. I finished all of that. I love it. But I gotta say, big map. Needs more shit in it. Please.
There's only so many locations that you actively return to again.
Yeah, and obviously there are level-specific stuff too, but you see, that's the real trick. You need to make traversal through a space interesting.
There are lots of possibilities here too. There's a lot of freedom in where you go, what you do, how you do it.
You stab.
The choices have a pretty strong impact on things as well. And the world building is still excellent. The environmental storytelling, the stuff that you will just figure out. Like, you can go into people's apartments and learn so much about
through
them.
Their things.
Yeah, they've got, some of them got like secret rooms, some of them have got connections to organized crime, and you figure it out. You know, when you go to your work and there's your boss and there's your staff psychologist, whatever, you can just straight up go to their apartments and look through their shit.
And naturally, you did.
Oh yeah, I read all of their emails. Like, again, these things are like email simulators to me.
Lawson loves them. The newspapers you pick up. These games in particular.
Oh, RPGs. RPGs are my genre. Like,
RPGs are not. I'll say he loves them, but they're not good for him because they help him indulge in his worst habits.
You sent us.
Which is to read everything.
You sent us a series of messages on our group chat recently.
About
Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah, yeah.
And that seems... That
is the game that will kill you.
That legitimately terrifies
me. I'm going to have to play through, like, more than twice.
like, think?
Yeah.
The amount of granular detail here is staggering.
They've got a genital slider.
Mm-hmm. So did Cyberpunk 2077.
Well, that's different. That was not good.
That really got to me is the quote you picked out from one of the articles about it.
You can turn into a cheese
Baldur's
wheel.
Gate 3 has more cinematic dialogue than three times all three Lord of the Rings novels combined. It has 174 hours of cinematics, making it more than twice the length of every season of Game of Thrones combined.
Yep.
I think you can also shove House of the Dragon onto that.
Oh,
also.
Yeah, like, I played Elder Scrolls Oblivion for 6 months, and I racked up a total runtime of that is less than that duration of just cinematic dialogue in Baldur's Gate 3.
This is actual madness.
Makes you wonder where they're cutting their corners, because, I mean...
Well, it's a CRPG, so it's not like over the shoulder, or real time or anything. So I think you can probably get away with a lot more of the.
It's easier to manage in the format that it exists in, but that is still a staggering amount of.
So
content.
You are on your asshole run of this game. So it was basically a situation of the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun. Is an even worse dude with swords for hands.
Yeah, yeah, he's just gone crazy as often as possible. I did actually have to look up a couple of times, you know, could I actually get a worse outcome if I leave this person alive for a little while?
Because
sometimes they come back.
Point.
You don't want to just, like, off everyone you come across
then you soft-lock yourself.
Yeah.
No. Because if you kill everybody off, you might have someone who has more pain coming to them, and they need to experience that pain.
Like in that first, I'm just gonna make me sound like a lunatic. In Human Revolution, there's the guy that's the secretary at the police station.
The man who I have tortured for years.
He's been demoted because of the whole thing in his past with Jensen, but basically he's feeling sorry for himself. So when I went on into this police station and cut my, you know, with my knife arms. I looked it up and I made sure to keep him alive because he really takes the fall for letting you in there.
Yeah,
and,
then... if you kill, legitimately, I did this, if you kill everyone in the worst ways possible and you leave him, he gets fingered for the whole thing.
And you get off scot-free.
Well, you walk out the front door because who's going to stop you?
I don't think that happens.
You've killed all the cops.
Like, that's what I did, but then he just turns up at your apartment. Going on about how I think that happens also if you let him in but didn't kill anyone, because that's it's like the thing that tips them off is not the dead bodies, it's the stolen thing for the basement that you're actually there for. But then he confronts you and you basically I get to hit him with my knife arms in front of a lobby full of people.
Yeah,
anyways,
a lobby full of people. Who
we
got to
move on.
You.
We got to move on. The story is just sort of truncated in Mankind Divided, though it was allegedly. The first part of the story they had planned and they decided to split it in two. It does have some great thematic follow-on to the ideas of the first game. They progress them and take them in a new direction in a really interesting way. And as part of the world-building stuff, that's impeccable. The DLC is some really great sort of level design in microcosm. They create these like little arenas. Like, the stories in both of them are very fun. You got a lot of good, like, email reading. And but, like, it's this little gauntlet that you've got to work yourself through. They're very tightly designed maps. I really don't care
about...
That's
what I like about immersive sims.
I really don't care about the breach mode stuff that they shoehorned into the main game, though, as sort of this extra challenge mode. I tried it out a bit just to do my due diligence, but no, it's not my thing. I really do hope that now that the Embracer Group has embraced Eidos Montreal, that we do finally get our conclusion to this trilogy. I've said it before. I think I said it when I talked about Human Revolution. For me, I think that the idea is to you do the third version of the Jensen trilogy, then you remake Deus Ex 1, and then you continue on from there. Because I gather no one liked the second Deus Ex game, the original second Deus Ex game, so you just ignore it.
Well, and or the third, for a very different reason.
There wasn't a third, was there?
The third is Human Revolution.
Oh, really? Oh, sorry.
Deus Ex, Invisible War, Revolution, Mankind.
Sorry. Invisible War was the one with the nanite bombs.
But this is available on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, PC, and PlayStation 5 and Xbox Series X and S via backwards compatibility. It is... Also on Xbox, one of the ones that they have made 60 frames per second in backwards compatible. So, but it's only 900p, I think, resolution on the Xbox console. So it's sort of a trade-off, but that's where I played it.
How did it work out with that?
What do you mean?
Buttery smooth, as if as if a knife going.
Would you have preferred a higher resolution or? Are you resolution or frame rate? Which do you land
on? I'm usually resolution. I'm playing all my backwards compatible stuff on Xbox simply because there's just too much. I've encountered too many glitches on the PS5, so that's where I've gone. And they do some cool quality of life stuff on Xbox that I appreciate. But anyways, that's me done for the week.
All right, so now we're going to play for you the trailer to The Adjustment Bureau.
You're that guy running for Senate, aren't you?
I am that guy, yeah. Are you a registered New York voter?
Do I sound like I am? I gotta go. Sorry.
How was that? I don't know.
Challenge me in those shoes?
What is this? We are the people who make sure things happen according to plan. We monitor the entire world. Oh.
Can't outrun your fate, David.
You've just seen behind a curtain that you weren't even supposed to know existed. This is your plan, and we're determined to keep it that way. You bumped into a woman this morning on the bus.
Were you just staring at my legs?
I was defenseless against the dress.
What does that have to do with anything? Your path through the world is supposed to have been adjusted. You weren't ever supposed to see her again.
If you truly love her,
just
walk away.
If you stay with her, it not only kills your dreams, but it kills hers.
I don't care what you put in my way, I'm not giving up.
They're making a run for it.
What the hell is going on?
I need you to trust me.
Okay.
All I have are the choices I make, and I choose her.
Just remember, we tried to reason with you.
That was the trailer for The Adjustment Bureau. It is a romantic fantasy thriller directed by George Nolfi, and it is based on the 1954 Philip K. Dick short story, Adjustment Team. The film follows New York State Congressman David Norris, played by Matt Damon, who has been trying to make the jump to federal Congress. He was doing pretty well until images of him mooning his former classmates at his college reunion went viral, because sure, that's all it would take to kill the political career of an outsider politician from New York. He's writing his concession speech in the bathroom of a hotel lobby when he meets Elise Sellers, played by Emily Blunt, who has taken refuge in the men's room while fleeing after gate-crashing a wedding. David and Elise instantly hit it off, and her bubbly charm inspires him to wing his speech, disrupting the blandly political mechanics of the event in so memorable a way that he becomes an instant front-runner for the next election. A month later, while catching the bus to his new corporate job, he runs into Elise again, and this time he gets her number. Everything's going David's way, until he reaches work and finds his colleagues frozen in place while men in suits scan them with wild-looking technology. David is captured by the men, and one of them, Richardson, played by John Slattery, helpfully explains that he has stumbled onto the work of the Adjustment Bureau, an interdimensional cabal of omnipresent observers tasked by someone known only as the Chairman with guiding the world along a predestined path. They are, Richardson cheerfully reveals, the inspiration for God and his angels. David was never supposed to find out about them. In fact, he was never supposed to meet Elise again. A member of the Bureau, a weary-looking man named Harry, played by Anthony Mackie, was supposed to keep him from making the bus, but he fell asleep on the job. Now, David has to keep his mouth shut and never see Elise again, or they'll lobotomize him. Turns out, David is destined to become a once-in-a-generation political leader, but that'll never happen if he diverts from the plan. They confiscate Elise's number and send him on his way. The concept of free will is a difficult one to keep down, however, especially when destiny seems to be helping it along. Despite the Adjustment Bureau's best efforts, David and Elise's paths continue to cross, prompting the Bureau to call in Thompson, played by Terrence Stamp, an old-school fire and brimstone type, to crack some heads together. Still, David has astonishing luck, and soon, a regretful Harry begins to wonder if the plan just might be wrong. So, before we get too deep into this, why don't we each go around and give our timed 30-second thoughts on the Adjustment Bureau? Why don't you start us off, Sean? Are you ready?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I really enjoyed this. I thought this was wildly entertaining. I love all of the talk of predestination and fate and going against the plan. And I think Matt Damon and Emily Blunt have incredible chemistry here. And it just jumps out of the screen at you. I was thoroughly entertained by this. And I just love a lot of Philip K. Dick's imaginative ideas.
All right, you ready, Harley?
Yep.
3, 2, 1, go.
I really, really dug this. I've also listened to a reading of the short story it's based on, and this is a good deal less scary than that. What this is, however, is a little more compelling. It's got this wonderful concept of this group of interdimensional beings who basically try and shepherd humanity along in the best way they know how. And the best way they know how
is like the Men in Black, which is really, really fun. Whole cast is really strong, and it's really compelling.
I really, really enjoy this. I think the Adjustment Bureau is a fantastic concept. I really love all of the weird little pieces of politics that go on in that. But I also am really connected to the David and Elise story as well. I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff brought up there. Free will versus predestination, personal happiness versus public responsibility. I think that there's a lot under the hood in this movie, and I love how strange it is and how ambitious it is as a story, considering it stars Matt Damon and Emily Blunt.
Yeah. Tonally speaking, this reminded me a lot of Vanilla Sky.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Not right down to the confrontation on the roof where some gun comes out and explains everything.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, Vanilla Sky is a hell of a lot weirder.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly by essence of Tom Cruise, but this does have that same energy. And it's an energy I like to describe as love conquers all.
Even interdimensional.
The idea that the idea that at the end of everything, what humans do best is love. And that's a very interesting idea for a Philip K. Dick story, especially since the Adjustment Team is a lot freakier as a concept. Have you read the Adjustment Team?
I haven't, no. I know okay. that the Anthony Mackie character is like a dog or something.
Yes, he's an actual dog.
Yeah, so I think what the explanation was is the dog is meant to run up and interrupt the dude while he's walking to work.
No, no. Instead of being ahead of time, like David is in this movie, he's late to work. So the dog is supposed to basically signal to him that he's meant to move and get going to work, and so that changes the entire because the dog falls asleep, he gets hung up with talking to an insurance salesman, so he arrives to work late. Where it differs in concept is what the world looks like frozen and how it operates frozen. It is basically as if the entire world has its color and light drained away.
Sort of like Langoliers.
And everyone becomes as dust. So the Adjustment Bureau then travel through this terrifying hellscape, making the adjustments they need to do. But the adjustments they need to do can be much, much more wide-ranging. They can change your age. They can change your entire temperament. They can basically do whatever they need to do to get the plan
back on track.
Back on track. And I understand why changes were made. Because
Anthony
Mackie
voicing a dog in this would be kind of a weird choice.
It's so intense.
But can you imagine if what they did in this is that it's all of these dudes in suits and hats standing on top of a building being like, okay, time to get moving. And then they just turn to a dog and the dog's wearing a little hat.
I have to
and
admit.
They have to, and they say to him, you're looking tired. Maybe you should go on a vacation.
Well, that sort of reminds me. One of the things that it also reminds me of is Fringe, the TV show Fringe. Because a big element of Fringe is these sort of bald men in suits and hats who are called the observers, and they will just watch.
Yeah.
And they're actually in the background of pretty much every episode, even when it's not like a big, you know, lore heavy episode. They'll just
they've got to be paying attention,
standing in a crowd watching, and it is kind of the same thing where they are. I won't spoil what the observers are, but they also are monitoring to make sure things go in a very specific way.
It's such a fascinating view backstage, in a way. I always love it when movies and fiction just in general present that type of idea. The idea that the world around us is real, but there is something a step removed from that. The idea that it's kind of like the idea behind the first concept of the back rooms as a concept. The idea of, like you said, in Fringe, these people who are just always watching.
It goes back to a lot of conspiratorial thinking, this great them, you know.
Yeah.
they don't want you to know. It is their plan. The ever-present, ever-powerful they. And I love seeing the backstage of the they. How the agents of this organization, the Bureau, have little infights. They do jabs against each other.
They've got
office politics. Like, all of that stuff is fascinating. I would love a TV show, like, a honest to God, like Skins or friggin' Bull, where it's just
agents from the Bureau and just having to get shit done.
That would be fantastic.
Mm. There was that animated show that Netflix did but cancelled called Inside Job, which is like the inside runnings of the deep state.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's the thing that this movie does, though, is it kind of sidesteps a lot of that sort of Illuminati stuff. The sort of mysterious organization thing is present, but it's couched in...
They're beyond that.
Yeah. A theological sort of thing.
Yeah.
That we learn, like, the way that Slattery just drops it, and Matt Damon has no follow-up questions whatsoever, that that they are basically God and his angels, that the chairman is God, or is what the world interprets as God.
The author of the plan.
Yeah. He's the guy that wrote the plan, that rewrites the plan when need be, that keeps it all running. And we, like, he just straight up is God. Every culture's God. We just all have different names for him, and they are his angels.
And the Adjustment Bureau always micromanages.
Hmm.
And I love when...
Does that mean that Jesus was a Bureau agent?
Perhaps not.
Not necessarily, because they don't actually use any specific language to do with specific religions. It's always...
It's much broader.
It's a broader thing of if
perhaps
there is
Jesus
a
was the
creator.
Perhaps Jesus, in this particular scenario...
Maybe there was someone who saw behind...
No, perhaps...
And was told to take the fall.
Perhaps Jesus Christ was, in this particular scenario, a chosen person by the chairman so that a sort of message could come out?
Well, here's the question. Well, here's an interesting question. I want to find this...
Because Christianity might have become important to the plan. Because you can't...
Well, in that sense that he wouldn't have been specifically, like... told or authored. Would have been
his life was written to be this way.
Because it was part of the plan.
The necessity
the same
of,
way that all of those things were part of the plan.
Yes. The necessity of being where and when he was.
Yeah.
The necessity of the sacrifice.
Hmm.
The necessity of all the performances of the miracles, which the Bureau could absolutely create.
I just want to read you this quote that the Terrence Stamp character has. We actually tried free will before. After taking you from hunting and gathering to the height of the Roman Empire, we stepped back to see how you'd do on your own. You gave us the Dark Ages for 5 centuries, until finally we decided we should come back in. The chairman thought maybe we just needed to do a better job of teaching you how to ride a bike before taking the training wheels off again. So we gave you the Renaissance, the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution. For 600 years, we taught you to control your impulses with reason. Then in 1910, we stepped back. Within 50 years, you'd brought us World War I, the Depression, Fascism, the Holocaust, and capped it off by bringing the entire planet to the brink of destruction in the Cuban Missile Crisis. At that point, a decision was taken to step back in again before you did something that even we couldn't fix. So...
The coldest thing that you could say to a person. Yeah.
What's the last 5 years been then, Adjustment Bureau? Like, fucking Anthony Mackie asleep on the job again.
Yeah. So are they really trying to tell me, and you'll probably have to remove this, 9/11 was an inside job?
Well, technically, all of the deaths, all the disasters...
Because
that were
that was
in
within
these...
that was within the period in which they had stepped back in.
On.
Yeah.
It's all that they're explaining is that there were certain blocks of time where they stepped away, which were just humans. So I think you'd have to figure out exactly what those blocks are, and within those blocks, where the
Bureau said no. What Harley's saying is He's being somewhat facetious, but it is a decent point in the sense that, you know, it does mean that they are the orchestrators of all of these tragedies. Yeah. And
it's an inherently significant historical event that put the world into movement.
Yeah.
It is,
and that
in
does
this
go
particular
to,
circumstance,
and that does
you
go to,
must.
That does go to yeah. a particularly thorny religious problem that comes up a lot, I think, when talking about religion and God, and that is the sense of, well, if everything happens for a reason, then why does God allow all the terrible shit to go down?
Yeah.
And that it is kind of engaging with that, this movie, but not completely. I mean, it is part of the plan, I suppose. You never really
it
get
doesn't
the point.
Want to talk
it
about
doesn't
it.
Want to talk about it. Matt Damon never has that conversation of, hey, Terrence Stamp, why'd you let 9/11 happen? When it does sort of raise the question, but it also, I think, plays into the sort of view of the Adjustment Bureau that this movie has of being a sort of cold and impersonal organization.
Mm. They're not evil.
No.
They're never portrayed as such.
Terrence Stamp gets close, but that's because he's Zod.
He's just the bruiser Terrence that they bring in yeah. for the particularly recalcitrant like, problems.
Yeah. He's the guy who's basically like, you want to play hardball?
Okay.
We can play hardball, and it's a harder ball than you've ever seen before.
You get the impression he's been around a lot longer than the others. Because
yeah.
they say...
You get the feeling that this was the dude who...
Kicking it upstairs.
Yeah, you get the impression that maybe Richardson and Mackey have been around for the Cold War correction, but he's been around since the first time they tried taking
since
the wheels
the beginning.
Off. He's seen every time that we've screwed up,
yeah.
and that's
yeah.
sort of like and that's like they say that they're not immortal, that they just live a lot longer than human beings. And you
like
wonder whether
concept...
maybe this is of just a very old guy who has seen a lot more than these other guys have.
Yeah, but even at that point, it's like, if you are an immortal, if you live for, say, 5 centuries, if you can live to 500, and that's sort of the limit for them, still, that there's a lot of... We don't know if they are immortal or not.
Well,
they
also
just imply that they die or just.
Here's the thing.
Well, they don't say that they are immortal. They say that we live a lot longer than human beings.
Yeah,
that could mean
anything.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things with the Bureau members specifically is they have limitations placed upon them by the chairman. So, these limitations including. The ability to work through doors while wearing their special fancy-ass hats. They can't do that without the hats. They can't read minds, even though they can see the decision pathways sort of out in front of them.
Well, they know they're on script. They know the plan, and they know if things go off script, and they've got to get it back on script again, but they're not omnipotent.
Their abilities are hampered by the presence of water. The presence of rain.
Yes, because witches can't cross running water.
Neither can vampires in old stories.
But that's the really compelling thing here. The chairman built them with limitations.
Well, that's the thing.
Built them with the chance.
Did he build them?
Fail.
Was this thing always the plan to begin with?
They get tired.
You don't know. You can't know.
Yeah. But that's the thing that they sidestep is that where we are coming at this, accepting that the same, because they say that basically the chairman is God or the inspiration for every culture is God, that the same rules that apply to God apply to the chairman,
no,
that he built everything.
They explicitly say that the chairman gave them limitations.
Okay, yeah.
The chairman is the one who instituted the idea that water mucked around with their abilities. And that's what's so interesting about the beginning when Anthony Mackie misses his cue.
Was that
he falls asleep? He falls asleep and then gets woken up by a ray of sunlight. So he gets woken up too late, but he still gets woken up with the time to witness everything, which then spurs on his own decision making throughout the rest of the film.
So that's interesting. So it's like the chairman's playing 4D chess.
The chairman is playing 4D chess, and the Bureau themselves are not. they're not outside of the pattern. They're not outside of anything.
That the book that they're seeing is only half the picture.
They're integral to the picture itself.
That is interesting, because it does sort of...
Then it's like, why can't you just do it right the first time, is my question.
No,
that's very complicated.
Because this is
the chairman.
Because this is how it must be.
According to, I assume, the chairman above the chairman, the president
of
the company.
Yeah, well, that's, again, we're getting back into the question of why the whole roundabout thing. You're basically asking what the meaning of... You're asking what the meaning of life is, Sean. You're asking what the meaning of life is.
Yeah,
that's,
I know.
It's because the author said so. I got a bit of a meta reading out of this. The plan is the script, is the series of events that have to go exactly the same way as detailed... Or things go off book, and people start to have to improvise. And as is established by Harry, they don't do improvisation very well. In fact, they're really, really bad at it. At every opportunity we're given to see them try to get things back on track, they suck at it.
Oh, at one of the points, they do send in Pedro Pascal for a very short 4 seconds of screen time as a maitre d' at a restaurant.
And that's what gave me a sort of meta reading on this. What happens when the characters you're writing sort of deviate? What do you do then as a writer in this concept to put them back on track? Do you break the story to put them back on track, or do you nudge them back on track? So what the Bureau has been trying to do thus far is nudge them back on track.
So you reckon...
Until Thompson has to be brought in to swing the hammer down.
So you reckon... That the entire drama of it was the chairman's point.
Yes.
That it was not only that Elise and David were just the vehicle to teach something to the Bureau itself.
Because the Bureau have been really, really hands-on for the last, 50 years?
60 at that point.
60 years?
So what you're implying...
You're right, 50. 60 now, 50 now, 50 then.
So it's like... The idea that perhaps the Bureau themselves have gotten so invested in their own purpose that they forgot the point.
You're not wrong that the person who seems to learn the most from the whole thing is Anthony Mackie's character.
Because at the end, Elise, her mind has been blown apart by all of this. She walks through a door and now she's in Dodger Stadium. She walks through a door. She's on the top of the Chrysler Building. Like, she's got no clue what is happening.
They use New York really well. Like, they used all the locations and things in such a great way.
And I love seeing...
The doors are such a cool concept.
I love seeing the difference when, you know, we go to where David grew up and that nightclub and how different it is to the places he's doing the speeches at and all of the... hoity-toity buildings that he visits, and then in that last sequence, obviously, we just run through the greatest hits of New York. We go to, obviously, the Chrysler Building, we go to Dodger Stadium, we go to the...
MoMA.
Museum of Modern Art. We go to, you know, Liberty Island. We go see the Statue of Liberty, which is funny, because apparently... On set, when they were filming that, people actually just started yelling out, Matt Damon!
In that silly voice?
Yes, from Team America.
Which is really funny. Just one more thing I wanted to add. The idea of bringing in... Thompson's idea of bringing in Elise's ex to essentially simply be a plot point.
Well, no, because that's how the plan was supposed to go. Like,
no, but like what I mean is... Elise's ex is merely a plot point in this. He's not a person, really. And that itself is an interesting idea that... We're seeing this from David's perspective,
yeah?
He's the main character here. But there's people running all over the shop with Bureau agents specifically set on them.
What about that woman who sees one of the Bureau agents run through a door, sees the opposite side of the door, the door closes, she goes back
Matt
through,
Damon doing it.
And it's just a cupboard.
Hmm.
What's her story?
Like,
what happens next?
And they also, the Bureau, I think Richardson, says that we don't have, like, granular control. When you choose what you want to eat, or you choose your toothpaste, It's that sort of shit that's up to you.
They push you to choose things that are going to have an effect. And yeah. I think it's
They do miss things. Yeah. Like, they say, we can't be everywhere all at once.
And I do love the way that they describe it as a chance meeting or someone looking at you on the street or you picking a different street to go down to get where you want to go, because all of that, every decision that is made there has a ripple and can come back twice as large.
Well, that's the interesting thing that constrains the Bureau is the ripples. Yeah. They can't do too much. Otherwise, the ripples start to change. The ripples themselves start to change the plan. Their actual actions in trying to get the plan back on track change other aspects of the plan. So they they have like a limit that they can go to. They have like a quota of like weird little like bewitched like nose wiggles that they can pull off before the chairman like shuts that shit down. They can't do anymore.
And I like the idea. I like how Richardson in particular is just like, all your life you want that one red envelope case. You want the case that'll make your career. And then fate steps in and messes up the entire thing for you. Like, they fall victim to fate, just like everybody else.
And I do love how that, when they kidnap David, they take him to the warehouse, and they're doing the whole rigmarole of, I'm sure David thinks he's been kidnapped by a bunch of government people.
Madsen's about to come out. Dancing the stuck in the middle with you.
Yeah, exactly. And you got the other guys.
If it was still Terrence Stamp.
Yeah, and you got this guy saying, "Well, you could do what we did, you know, back with that other case." And the guy's like, "Really? You just told them everything?" It's like, yeah, you just have to get them to promise to shut their mouth.
Which is funny because that's what happens in the adjustment team. Like, the way that things appear to function is pretty much the same. They just dig into it a hell of a lot more here. Because the adjustment team as a story is like 52 minutes as an audio experience, and it's like a full feature film here, so they had to expand concepts.
I do love the appearance of Terrence Stamp here, because he really is that severe person who you send to tell someone. You're not asking, you are telling them something.
But another interesting concept is David and Elise here. The part that really got to me is when Terrence Stamp's character Thompson was like, if you stay together, it's not your destiny that will be forfeit. It's hers. Because if you walk away right now, she will become one of the most influential dancers and choreographers this country has ever seen. If she stays with you, she teaches kindergarten dance.
Oh, the horror. The horror of teaching children to dance.
And it's like,
I'm just sitting here thinking,
and my response is like,
that's still a position in which you can create those ripples that you can inspire.
She could still inspire and change lives teaching children dance. And that's the thing that a lot of the Bureau members are missing.
They think on the macro
scale. They think in terms of grand gestures and grand moments. When it's the little thing. It's the little things that drew David and Elise together.
Coincidence.
And it is that only Harry seems to fully recognize.
The fact that when they see each other again, when he sees her on the street after losing her number, they're like, I'm sorry, what?
I like how Richardson was like,
after 5 months, I'm still fixing your mistake because of luck.
Richardson just looks at the book, he's like,
well, it's not 5 months, it's like 3 years.
Yeah,
it's 3 years. Yeah,
he looks at it and he's like, God,
son of a damn bitch. It. Son of a bitch.
Because then the excuse that's given is this is all the hangover of a previous version of the plan. Like, this is the interesting thing, is that the plan is constantly rewritten. It's iterative, yeah. And you sort of get the impression, like, there is that exchange that Stamp has with Damon. Damon says, after that whole speech about free will, I don't know if you've looked around, but the world isn't exactly a great place. And Stamp says, but it's still here. Without us, it wouldn't be. So you sort of like almost get the impression where the Bureau are kind of like just pulling it, like we're the children trying to you know, stick forks into the power socket or something.
Yeah.
And no matter what they do, we still keep making a beeline to that power socket. And it's really just this give and take. They're fully aware that the world is still a mess.
They're poking their fingers into holes in a dam.
Yeah. They're doing their best. Yeah. It's like the in the cartoon, you know, Bugs Bunny's climbing up the ladder as it's sinking down into the hole.
The world is held together with duct tapes and twine.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting idea. I will say that I think that the chemistry between Blunt and Damon is really on point. Oh, it's very strong.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like you especially Blunt, like you really buy this relationship, and you have to. You have to buy the dynamic, because they actually don't spend all that much time on screen together. I mean, Damon spends more time with Slattery and Mackie than he does with Blunt, I think.
And he doesn't try to kiss them.
No.
Yeah.
Not on camera.
Shame.
Anyway. But it's really important that you buy the sort of idea that these people are fated, even though fate says they're not.
Yeah, you have to believe that after that first meeting that they're both down bad. And that this is not a thing that's going to fade with time.
Well, and that's the thing. They are, Blunt and Damon are both consummate professionals. By this point even, like, they just give themselves fully over to the characters and concept.
Yeah.
Like, the way I look at Matt Damon is, it's if Mark Wahlberg could act.
Yeah.
You tell me I'm wrong.
You're not wrong.
It is a cruel thing to say on Wahlberg's part.
Because you tell me one single Mark Wahlberg.
It's pretty cruel
Wahlberg,
to Matt Damon too.
you tell me one Mark Wahlberg role that Matt Damon couldn't have absolutely smashed.
Father Stew.
Okay.
They're both from Boston. I mean, that's really all it takes, isn't it?
But still, Blunt is perhaps a lot stronger with the chemistry here. She does a shitload of the heavy lifting when it comes to the chemistry.
Damon's no slouch either.
He's no slouch either, but he's got a lot more other stuff to do. And I guess it really is that matter of priorities. Whenever Blunt is on screen, it's about David. When Matt Damon is on screen, it's mostly about Elise, but he's got some other shit going on too. Like, and running.
I love the way that they film all of that intro stuff, how this is David. He is a firebrand. He is going to be the future of this country. And they do all of these vox pops and the little things with Wolf Blitzer and Jon Stewart and all of that stuff. And they get really good mileage out of it. They have him...
Yeah.
The director films these like they are legitimate news things. Like, this is for a campaign, you know, piece of media.
But I also like that David very clearly was a Democrat pick. They never say it, but he is running against the Republican in the race. And I don't know, there's something interesting about a firebrand Democrat.
Where do you get
Democrat.
That from? I'm not sure I'm not saying it wrong, but I'm saying I don't think there's anything.
It's the R next to the opponent's.
Ah, name. Right, yeah.
Tends to indicate that much.
okay, Harley.
So, that sounded more hostile than it was intended. But politics isn't really of interest to the story. It is simply a vehicle with which to say that David can have a huge impact.
Yeah.
Maybe David was supposed to be president now, and him not is why everything's so fucked up.
Thanks, David.
It
really screwed it all up for the rest of us. But I'm so glad that she's able to teach kids dance.
But I really do love that part where he was so impacted by simply meeting Elise that he did.
He dropped the bullshit.
He dropped the bullshit and was like, "No, we focus tested how scuffed my shoes could be." We couldn't have them too scuffed, or we would alienate the bankers and the money people, but they couldn't be too clean because we would alienate all of the working class people. We hired a person, we paid them $74,000.
$7,400, I think.
$7,400 to figure
tell me
out
exactly how scuffed
exact
my shoes should be.
Scuffiness of these shoes.
I don't really buy that would be the electoral catnip that this movie seems to think it is. It's like, Hey,
well, I also don't buy the idea of him ruining friends at college.
We've been manipulating you for an entire campaign, but I promise I won't do it again. Like,
no, but I mean, like, people like to see genuine stuff or stuff they read as genuine.
Mm.
Yeah, but even then, he's still doing a performance. And it is this whole thing of, I do agree with you that it very much has the equal possibilities of getting a lot of voters really interested in him, but also alienating,
yeah. But like,
you know, the mainstay.
Next election cycle, the attack ad is just him saying that he paid $7,400 to find out how much his shoes should be scuffed appropriately, like, manipulate the voting public. Like,
yeah.
You know, the people who are, what would you call it? The established politicians, like the establishment politicians, the people who are basically
career
wallpaper
career
of DC would be like, this Joker.
No, I actually think a lot of them would just say, so.
I think people already know that it's a performance. It's just he's outright breaking kayfabe, to use a wrestling.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is like, get some people on board, but.
But the politics really is just backdrop.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's just something about Damon's character who feels. I don't know. I don't know what I was trying to say, but the ending felt too easy.
Yeah, and it also does muddle some of the thinking a little bit. Like, free will succeeds only in so much as the chairman allows it.
Yeah. Like, the chairman does give them that blank slate that they can forge their own path, but they're still going to have an impact on the people around
them.
Does
he just rewrite the plan so that they're now locked onto the tracks again, but, you know, he's just papered over the little gap that they had found?
It's free will from a certain point of view.
Yeah. Like, they've still got to live with the fact that at any point, at any moment in time,
Terrence Stamp
can
just show up.
And they will never know if what is happening to them at that moment is part of the design.
Okay.
They will never have that proper assurance that they are free. In essence, they are still locked, but they are in a gilded cage with visitation privileges.
Okay, so I think my thoughts on how the ending left me were crystallized when I finished the Philip K. Dick short story. The ending of the story is, this guy that we've been following this entire time has been spoken to by one of the dudes from up top, and he was like, okay, so just don't tell anyone a damn thing about a damn thing, and you'll be fine. But if you tell anyone, if you speak to your wife about any more of this, it's game over. Not just for you, but for her as well. So get it together and get out. Then he gets shoved back onto his front step when he walks in, because he's been gone all day. He didn't even make it. When he made it into work, he started freaking out because everything was slightly different, and it just, like, messed. It didn't line up with his head, right? Which is a terrible concept in and of itself. But when he walks in, she's like, where the hell have you been all day? And when he tries to lie, he's a pretty shit liar and can't think of anything even remotely close to what actually happened. She starts going off on him, and he cannot even make a convincing lie. Like, I had to speak to someone about my mental break that I told you about. And the punchline at the end of it is so brutal and so dark. There is a knock on the door, and a vacuum cleaner salesman comes into the room, here to display his stuff and show them. The trick with that is, earlier in the story, the adjustment team at his office was using tools and gadgets and gizmos that resembled vacuum cleaners to sort of perform the adjustments and suck stuff away. And after he starts going, so, this is all my stuff, this is all my vacuum cleaning stuff, wink, wink, cut. Then when it comes back in, the guy's on his bed, and he's just staring straight ahead saying, thank you. I don't know how I'd be able to get through that myself. And that's fucking brutal.
Because his wife's mind
gets erased with the entire day's events. so he can continue with his lie. Because when he has seen behind the curtain, there's only two solutions. You're either gone completely, or you promise not to tell anyone anything about what you saw. There is no middle ground. And
we are running out of time here. But
it's just the way that it was written that came across as very blunt, very brutal, and got across the idea that the Adjustment Bureau are a necessary evil, but there is still something inherently terrifying about the fact that what you think you know might not actually be what you knew before. The world is simply on an iterative system that sort of saves scums so it can get the right turn of events.
There was a different ending that the director was forced to cut.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Apparently, the studio forced him to cut it, from what I can tell from all of the different weird little accounts. You were going to see the chairman, and the chairman was going to be played by Shaura Agdishlu, who, do you guys know her? You would know her voice.
The name.
You would know her voice immediately.
And I'm going to make you fall asleep using only the power of my voice.
Like,
oh.
You would know her voice.
Yeah.
But she was going to come out at the end and be the chairman. And there was some read between the lines. No one's ever really come out on it. You know, matter of fact, sure, Agdishlu has just straight up written about it in her memoir that the director was very upset that he had to cut her and was apologizing, saying the studio was making him. And that the studio said that she couldn't play the part. And it makes you wonder whether it was that she was a woman playing essentially God.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But a Muslim woman.
So you do wonder whether that's the I don't know anything about Shaura Agdishlu's religious beliefs myself, but Middle Eastern certainly. And I think that is clearly missing from the ending. You're missing that catharsis of the match.
Anthony Mackie just rocks back up.
Yeah. And you sort of wonder, like, he even points it out, like, no, I am not the chairman, because you sort of are wondering. But you're left with a chairman-shaped void in that ending.
Part of me likes that, though. I can see how it works, because, you know, personifying the chairman has its own amount of... You lose some of the mystery behind the chairman. You know what I mean? You do want to leave some elements up to interpretation and up to mystery. But I certainly would have liked to see the chairman. You know, it's one of those balancing acts. You know what I mean? You could reveal not enough or reveal too much, and I think they hit a sweet spot.
Yeah,
or at least they're close.
And I do love how they have Terrence Stamp come in at the end of that chase scene before he gets handed the thing and pisses off. He says, "Did you really think that you were going to run all this way, climb up all those stairs, walk through a door, and get to meet the chairman? Did you really think that?" And that is sort of a moment where it's like, yeah, fair enough. That makes sense.
Anyways, I feel like we're reaching the end of our conversation here, and we do now have a fairly, or what has been, a fairly time-consuming new segment, which is who would cast in the Muppet version of this movie, the Muppet Adjustment Bureau. I think that the really, really obvious play is to make everyone human except the Adjustment Bureau. The Adjustment Bureau is just the Muppets.
So we need to pick Harry Richardson. Richardson's offsider.
Well, Richardson's offsider could be anyone.
I forget the actor, but I've seen him in a lot of stuff, and he's pretty good here too. Thompson, and I don't know.
Why not the chairman?
We could throw the chairman in there.
Well, Kermit's the chairman.
Absolutely. Harry.
Harry, I'd go Fozzie.
Okay. I think Richardson and his offsider, Beaker and
Honeydew. Yeah.
And you have Sam the Eagle come in as...
I say you get Statler and Waldorf. You do what they did in Christmas Carol where they made one character
They are Thompson.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah.
And have them sort of just yelling mean, dispiriting things.
And what's so cool is in those sequences when you see Harry at the library, wink, wink, it's just full of Muppets.
Yeah. Yeah, it just walks into a Muppet set.
It's full of Muppets with suits. Yeah. And that And that's really fun. That's a very fun idea.
And it leads us into the very funny situation where we see Fozzie Bear get hit by a taxi. And I mean, that's incredible true. In and of itself.
No. Harry is Rolf. He was meant to be a dog in the first place.
Actually, that is a funny gag.
You can't pass
gag.
That up.
That is a funny gag.
Exactly. Yeah, that's fine. You referenced the original story.
And do the human characters make any note of the fact that they're Muppets?
Never.
Or it's just the normalest thing in the world.
Normalest thing in the world.
It's the adjustment part of it, which wigs them out.
Well, they never really draw notice to it in any of the other
That's fair.
Any of the other ones.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, now why don't we move on to the IMDb Parents Guide segment, which for the uninitiated is where we talk about the IMDb Parents Guide sections for the movie that we are discussing this week. The sections that are user submitted and are usually either prudy or pervish, sometimes both. This time I would say it moves in the pervish direction.
Yeah.
Because all three of these items are from the sex and nudity section.
Of course.
Is it one of the interpretive dance sequences?
No. Elisa's cleavage is seen many times along the film.
Oh my god.
David,
these people.
David and Elise have sex. Although there is no nudity, you can see bare shoulders and them kissing. After the sex, they sleep in the same bed that night.
Scandalous. Holy shit.
David stares at Elise's legs while she is sleeping on a bus. No nudity.
Kaboom would make this person's head explode. They wouldn't be able to continue living.
Now, why don't we each go around and say who our MVP is for this movie, what our favourite scene or sequence is, and of course, who we would recast with this podcast's patron saint, character actor, John Lithgow.
Knock, knock, who's there? Me!
Now, ground rules, they have to be people who were in this movie, not in deleted scenes.
Yeah.
Correct.
I wanted to get that out of the way.
We can't just...
Because you knew where my head was going.
Yeah.
I will start us off and I will say that my MVP here for the movie is Emily Blunt. I think that she is giving a really bright and sort of vibrant performance. And she, I actually think, has a more difficult job than Damon because we're with Damon the whole time.
Yeah.
She's got to turn up and make Elise viable as a happily ever after pretty much immediately. And then for us
and
to
be
really...
worth ruining the world for.
Yeah. And then for us to buy not only that as a ideal outcome, but buy that David would continue in his efforts to reunite with her. And she does. I think she has great chemistry with Damon. I think she's fun. She's funny. She's very enjoyable every time she comes on screen. So I'm going to give it to her. In terms of my favorite scene or sequence, I'm going to go with the first time we see Terrence Stamp when he turns up to confront David after he is sort of tricked back into the cosmic warehouse. And he gets that dynamite speech about all of the times that humanity fucked up. And really just, it's just so cold and so clinical.
He puts humankind on trial there,
but also there's no like there's nothing villainous about it. There's nothing you know malicious.
He's the stern voice.
He's just a guy doing his job, you know.
And he feels sad whenever it's like, and then we had to come back.
Yeah,
in. It's like he's sad and he's disappointed.
He's not mad.
Yeah,
he's disappointed.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go with that scene. And following on from that, I think that the Lithgow recast is obvious. The recast is Thompson. I think he fits perfectly in that role of that very steely disciplinarian guy. I think he would bring all of the gravitas that Stamp does. And I think he would really nail all of that dialogue, those monologues. The sort of kind of chilling, but also in the end... just purely functional role that character fulfills is such an interesting one. And I think that he could definitely walk that line. We would also get to see him, you know, dramatically walking down hallways while wearing a scarf at the end. And, you know, how can you pass that up?
So for me, I would have to say my MVP is Emily Blunt. Elise is a character we have to damn near fall in love with the first time we meet her. And in that... That lets us buy David as a character. That the whole emotional crux of the film is Elise and David, and the lengths that David will go to say no to the assigned fate given to him and say, I love her.
Yeah.
And Blunt has to give us that. The script does a lot of work, but it is Blunt's delivery that if she was the one actor that didn't work here, it all falls apart. Every other domino does not fall. Blunt is the crux here that makes it work at the end of the day. And Blunt is phenomenal. Also, shout out to the performers who were doing her dancing and had her face digitally added onto in post.
No, she did
really
the dancing.
Really great work.
She did the dancing.
That's not what I read.
No, they got a whole behind-the-scenes featurette showing her doing the training for the dancing and doing the dancing.
Huh? What do you know? Credits and props on the dancing, too. Contemplative is a pretty difficult form.
Contemporary ballet, more than anything.
Yeah. I say this as someone with two left feet. My favorite scene or sequence is all the traveling through the doors and stuff. It's so compelling. It's such a fun idea that it is the doors that are the pathway here. It's not just them open up portals everywhere. It is the idea that anybody wearing one of those hats could just pop and fall into somewhere they're not supposed to be. They fall backstage, and it gives us that amazing chase sequence through the city and then through the bureau building itself. And that bureau building is fantastic as a location. It is brutalist as hell on the outside, but really cozy. Kind of like a New York Public Library inside, which, I don't know, there's something cool to that imagery there. And the breathtaking moment for me was not when they stepped out onto Liberty Island. It's when they stepped out into that stadium. Like, just the scope there, I was just like, damn, son. This is a very well put together and edited sequence. Whoever we replaced with the character actor John Lithgow, it's got to be Thompson. Thompson is, he's the hammer. He's the guy who sets shit right. He is a very stern character, but you can also tell he loves these knucklehead humans. He's doing what he does because he just wants what's best at the end of the day. He is so tired of them destroying themselves that in a way he's gotten a bit bitter. And that's some really compelling stuff to give Lithgow as a performer, because he can do that very stern voice of reason. Thompson is the Metaton, the voice of God. And John Lithgow has that poise, he has that precision as an actor, but he also has a sense of warmth that I think he could bring to the character that, yeah, Terrence Stamp can do, but I've seen him play too many villains to make him anything but chilling. Plus, as Lawson said, you got a lot of good of shots of him walking down hallways with a stern voice, agents filing in behind him.
Yeah, so I give it to Emily Blunt. I agree fully with everything you guys have said. You do need to fall in love with her character. You need to feel that as the audience, you were right there with Damon, and that you would risk, you know, fate to be with her. And they do such a good job at that, and Emily Blunt is just incredible here. Whenever she's given a character where she can really show off just how bubbly and quick she can be, she always excels at it, and I love seeing that from her. For my favorite scene or sequence, yeah, it's when Terrence Stamp rocks up, because he comes down like thunder from the gods. It's incredible, the icy way he speaks, with not contempt, but disappointment that he's had to be called in. The fact that he couldn't just be off somewhere else, that everyone else couldn't do their jobs properly, so he has to come in. And I just love the dialogue there. I think it's an incredible sequence. And who I would get John Lithgow as, I would actually have him as Harry. Replace Anthony Mackie with John Lithgow, because I feel like he could really play that underdog agent of the Adjustment Bureau. The fact that he makes this switch, that he decides to help David into...
And it would also emphasize the tiredness.
And he can add that sort of weariness that he's been doing this for a very long time and is getting tired by the impersonality of everything. The fact that all of the other people seem to be forgetting the entire point is to help humankind. And everyone else is just doing it in this cold, clinical way. And I think Lithgow could really play that switch. I wouldn't want to lose Terrence Stamp because the way he says those lines puts ice water into my veins. It's chilling the way he says it. He has a way of selling lines that I think is just incredible. So, yeah, I'd have him as Harry.
Yep. So, now we're going to put it to a vote whether or not we're a pro the Adjustment Bureau podcast or not. Lawson, cast your vote first.
I am saying pro. I think we should be. I think it's a very strong film, very entertaining, with a really great idea at its center. I think that the Adjustment Bureau itself is such a fantastic concept. It's well acted. It's well directed. I get a lot out of it. And it ties into ideas that I like. The literalization of luck and chance and the effect of that on a person's life. You know, free will versus predestination. These are all evergreen topics to me. I always find them interesting. So I'm saying yes.
For me, I would absolutely say yes. I've got pretty much nothing wrong with the movie. I like pretty much everything it's doing. It's a fantastic concept that they've taken from the Dick Short story, but expanded upon it in a lot of really cool ways. And it made me feel good at the end, which is not something you expect from a Philip K. Dick adaptation. There's a certain sense of bleakness to a lot of Dick's work that is not present here. It makes you feel hopeful, like you could, I don't know, fight against the tides of fate yourself, if given the prompting to. All the actors are fantastic. The script is very, very witty. We didn't say that enough. It's a very, very good script. But yeah, I'm a pro Adjustment Bureau podcaster.
Yeah, same here. For all of the reasons that you guys entailed, this was just thoroughly entertaining. It kept you guessing as to who the Bureau were, and everything is internally consistent. In order to have any kind of better explanation of what the whole plan means, you would literally have to discover the meaning of life. So I think this movie can be, you know, given a pat on the back for at least even going in that direction, even walking on that road for as long as they do. Do they reach the sort of end point of the theological question? No. But Jesus Christ, they go far, and I very much appreciate that they do.
Yep, so there you have it. We are a pro the Adjustment Bureau podcast. So, if you would like to reach us, you can find us at each of our blogs. You can find Lawson at Exit Through the Candy Counter with John and myself on the Bright Side. You can also reach us through our Twitter, which is the best place to give us episode-specific feedback and movie recommendations. Have you seen The Adjustment Bureau, and have you read The Adjustment Team? I would recommend looking up the audio for it on YouTube. There are a couple of really great readings of it that I listened to today. I would also like you to say what Philip K. Dick short story you would like to see adapted. Preferably one that hasn't been adapted thus far. Because you throw darts at a board and you kind of land on a adaptation of a Philip K. Dick story. But also you can like, rate, comment, and subscribe on the podcast app of choice. Keep in mind that on certain podcast apps, you're commenting on the show on the whole and on others on specific episodes. If you're commenting on the whole, make sure to let us know which episode you're talking about. Just let us know what you're talking about, to put it in a very blunt and overly complicated way. Please do like, comment, rate, and subscribe, though. There are adjustment teams in this robot-run future. They are machines that put people back on track, but it's certainly not to the extent presented in this film. No, the adjustment teams are basically sort of like acting coaches. If you're not doing so well at your diorama or going off book with it, for example, having kind of a meltdown, they will come in and sort of like set you straight on it, give you some tips about what you're supposed to do, show you some footage of that stuff happening in the before times, and basically then be on their path. So sometimes people need a little bit of direction and instruction. Yep, so Lawson, what do you have prepared for us next week?
Well, you know, there are two types of movies that we can never pass up the opportunity to do on the podcast. First of them, of course, is a movie starring John Lithgow, and I'm afraid we don't have one of those yet. It's been a long time between drinks, although I will say there is one coming up in the reasonably near future. The other type of movie, however, well, I suppose there are three types. The other would be Josh Hutcherson, just because we torture Sean, but with his hatred. But the one that I'm talking about today is a werewolf movie. We can't pass up the opportunity to do a werewolf movie on account of the fact that we are a pro-werewolf podcast. And this is definitely one of the stranger werewolf movies, just because it's a little out of left field. It is the 2011 adaptation, if you even want to call it that, of Red Riding Hood.
Red Riding Hood. God damn it.
Have you guys seen this?
Yeah, I've seen this.
Gary Oldman comes in as a werewolf hunter.
You were excited there for a minute, weren't you, Harley?
I thought we were going to get to like the other form of type of movie we always tend to do is like culturally significant, you know, films, the ones that like have a big moment about them.
What do you mean? It's Red Riding Hood. Like, how is that not exactly that? If you'd like to watch along at home, you can find it available for rental or purchase in Australia on the Apple, Amazon, YouTube, and Fetch stores.
I really hope we can find something not through using a VPN. Join us next week for when we discuss Little Red Riding Hood. Until then, I've been Holly Lewis.
I've been Lawson Keeney.
And I have been and will continue to be Sean Lewis.